Having left right after he climaxed during the previous encounter did not deter her from agreeing to meet him at a hotel to spend time together, which seemed hypocritical if, as she claimed, she really didn't want to just have sex, but also wanted some romance. She described the weekend as being more about sex than romance. "There was oral sex that weekend. We did what I guess he called, at the time he called it grinding, just being together but not actually having intercourse. It's something that I guess a lot of Mormons do, but they're not supposed to. There are different terms for it, such as the Provo push." "When you weren't engaged in sexual activity, how was he treating you?" Nurmi asked.
"He wasn't treating me bad. He just seemed checked out, you know, the whole time we were checked in. He was just kind of distant. I thought we connected a lot over the phone, and it was different when we were together. There wasn't much of a mental or emotional connection like there was on the phone. It was just primarily physical," Arius added, in a voice so low that Nurmi implored her to speak up so the jury could hear her response.
When he asked if she considered herself to be in a relationship with Travis at this point, she said,
"No," adding, "It was definitely not anything defined. We were sort of seeing each other, but we were definitely not boyfriend and girlfriend."
Not ready to leave the hotel encounter behind, Nurmi pressed her to list the number of times she and Travis engaged in sexual activity that weekend. When Arius said 3, he asked her to again describe them.
"The first night it was the grinding, and the next night it was the oral sex," she recounted.
"Okay. And what was the third night?"
"It was oral sex also, before we left."
"Okay. Did he ever express a desire during this weekend to engage in anal sex with you?" Nurmi asked, to which Arius said,
"Yes."
She further asserted that after the weekend in Ehrenberg, she felt
a little bit used.
"What do you mean, though, that you felt used?" Nurmi pressed.
"Well, you know, he gets a hotel room, I show up, we hang out, we have sex. He's not really there, present. He's not really mentally present. I'm getting a lot of attention, but only while we're engaging in sexual activity, and then we check out, and he takes off, and I kind of feel like a prostitute."
Arius testified that she called Travis several times after the weekend, but didn't hear back from him until Tuesday, when he left a very nice message on her phone, and the two resumed their frequent phone calls, which she said were both spiritual and sexual in nature. The trial became even more lurid when Nurmi showed Arius the first of 2 photographs that Dworkin had found on her hard drive and asked her to identify what the picture contained.
"It's an erect penis," she said,
which she claimed Travis sent to her cell phone on November 11, 2006. "Is this something that you solicited?" Nurmi asked as he displayed the first photograph on the monitor so that it flashed up on all the courtroom screens.
"Not directly," she replied, looking down. "I didn't expect a photograph, but we were flirting."
"This was a picture of his erection that he sent you, is that right?"
"Yes,"
Arius said, explaining that she was at a PPL event listening to speakers when she and Travis began texting.
"It turned flirty, and then it turned sexual. And it went on for hours, actually, back and forth, just trying to be witty and top each other's last comments."
"So he sent you 2 photos that day?" Nurmi solicited, showing Arius the second photograph, also featuring a man's erect penis.
"Yes, consecutively,"
Arius said matter-of-factly, telling jurors she had left the meeting and was in a restaurant with others when she opened the photo files and then quickly closed her phone so no one could see them. Because these photos were sent during Travis and Arius's courtship, more than 1.5 years before Arius killed him, there didn't appear to be a reason to introduce the pictures and make them part of the case other than to denigrate Travis in front of the jurors. Arius testified that 15 days later, on November 26, 2006, Travis baptized her into the Mormon church
during a small service in Palm Desert. After the ceremony, she said, Travis followed her back to her house in his car, and the two were again intimate, this time engaging in anal sex for the first time. But the two didn't start dating exclusively until February 2007, although even then, Arias claimed that Travis hid their relationship from most of his friends. Arias testified that they broke up 4 months later, on June 29th, after Arias went through his phone while he was napping and found numerous text exchanges with other women, leading her to believe he was being unfaithful. Still, she claimed that Travis called her the day after their breakup, telling her that he was horny and promising to change. Less than a month later, Arias moved to Mesa, and according to her, the two continued their sexual relationship. "Were you acting as a couple in public?" Nurmi asked.
"No, we were even more clandestine," Arias said, claiming the two had late-night rendezvous about 3 or 4 times a week.
She also alleged that Travis started being physically abusive to her, beginning with an incident in October 2007 when he pushed her down on the ground as she tried to leave the bedroom during an argument.
"We were arguing and I got up to leave and he wasn't done making his point, and he wanted me to stay so I guess he could finish yelling at me."
"What did Mr. Alexander say when he pushed you down?" asked Nurmi.
He said no like 5 times fast. "No, no, 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 you're not going anywhere."
According to Arias, the two made up, and their sexual relationship continued, during which time she alleged to have witnessed something so disturbing on January 21st, 2008, that it changed the course of their relationship.
"I walked in and Travis was on the bed, masturbating, and I got really embarrassed, even though we have been intimate more times than I could count. It was just kind of awkward walking in on him like that. And I was headed toward the dresser, but then I stopped, and I was trying to think of something funny or witty to say, like, 'Do you still need my help?' or something. And he started grabbing at something on the bed, and I realized they were papers, and as he was grabbing the papers, one kind of went sailing off the bed, and it fell in that chaotic pattern that paper falls, and it landed face up near my feet. And it was a photograph."
"What was in the photograph? What was the photograph of?" asked Nurmi.
"It was a picture of a little boy."
"Could you guess how old the little boy was?"
5-ish, 5, 6, Arias alleged. "I'm not a good judge of age."
Arias's testimony about this incident actually occurring was contradicted by what she had previously written in her journal, seized by police from her grandparents' Wairika home on the day she was arrested. In the entry for January 20, 2008, Arias acknowledges her failure to attend a friend's baptism because she and Travis were exploring their naughty fantasies that day. She does not write again in her journal until January 24, 2008.
"I haven't written because there has been nothing noteworthy to report for January 21st, 22nd, 23rd. The 3-day gap where she found nothing noteworthy to report happens to include the day she claims to have seen Travis masturbating to the picture of the little boy.
"Was the little boy dressed?" Nurmi inquired without addressing the journal entries during the direct examination.
"He was dressed in underwear, like briefs," Arias said.
She recalled being frozen for a moment, not sure how to react.
"It kind of seemed like one of those dreams where something is really off, but you just can't figure it out. And I turned to go and he called my name and I just ran."
Instead of calling the police or speaking with a Mormon bishop after leaving the house, she decided to return that same day, whereupon she said the two engaged in anal sex. Nurmi asked, "Why, Jody, were you willing to submit yourself to sexual interaction with Mr. Alexander, having seen and having heard everything you saw and heard that day?"
"It's hard to describe because it's very embarrassing. But he seemed very ashamed with himself. And he didn't want to be that way. It was something he struggled with. And that's not who he wanted to be.
It's not who he wanted to be in the future, and he was trying to deal with it. And when he had sex with women, he felt like a normal heterosexual man. And that's what he wanted to be, and that's what he said he was, and that's what I believed him to be. And so, when he had sex with women, he felt more normal, and it was preferable to his other deviant urges.
So you were doing this, having sex, to help him?
Yes, you could say that, Arius answered.
According to her testimony, she also helped by giving him some pamphlets that she found at the mall that she believed could be useful. Arius claimed that the following day, January 22nd, Travis was again physically abusive toward her, although, according to her journal, nothing noteworthy occurred that day. She testified that on that day, she was preparing to leave on a trip to California to see friends.
We were talking in his bedroom, and he told me he needed to borrow, I think it was $200. But I didn't have it. I'd just lent him $699 and, like, a few days prior, and I had just enough money to get to pay for the gas on my trip, maybe some food, and get back. I didn't really snap at him because he had reacted very badly in the past when I snapped at him. But I did say, I lent you $700, and when I said that, he got angry and he crossed the room and he started shaking me. He said, I'm fucking sick of you, and he's screaming real loud and some spit got in my face, and he body slammed me on the floor at the foot of the bed. It didn't hurt, but it startled me, and I kind of let out an unexpected sound. I guess it could be best described as a yelp. And I think he misinterpreted because he said, don't act like it hurts. He called me a bitch. He kicked me in the ribs, and that hurt for real. But he kicked me and I put my hand out to block his foot, and it clipped my hand and hit my finger. Arius described the ring finger on her left hand as being swollen and likely broken, as she held it up for the jury to see that it was bent at an angle. However, she admitted that she didn't seek medical attention or call the police in response to this supposed injury. Arius also claimed later in her testimony that in April, just days before she was set to move to Yreka, Travis just flipped his lid and blew up, and he threw me on the ground and got on top of me and started choking me. Arius went on, he squeezed my neck and I couldn't breathe. Everything turned gray really fast and then went black. I didn't have time to think, oh my God, he's going to kill me. The only thought I could think is, I can't breathe. I can't breathe, like I didn't have any air.
When court resumed on February 12th, Arius's fifth day of testimony, Nurmi introduced into evidence the sexually explicit conversation Arius had recorded on May 10th, 2008. Arius explained that she made the recording while she was at her grandparents' house in Yreka, where she was living at the time. She also claimed that she made the recording at Travis's request, although this request is not on the recording. To properly prepare those in the gallery, Judge Stevens asked that they have no reaction whatsoever to anything that is played for this jury, and if they believed they could not do so, they were asked to leave the courtroom. I had already played the audio recording for Travis Alexander's family, and they had determined that they wanted to be in court while it was played. Arius was on the witness stand when Nurmi began to play the approximately 45-minute recording over the courtroom loudspeakers, and an awkward placidity fell over the courtroom. The first voice we heard was Arius's, sounding a lot more animated and playful than she had throughout her testimony.
Okay, what did you say? I'm sorry, Arius says, opening the conversation, to which Travis responds in a groggy voice, indicative of just being awakened from sleep. I said, why don't we just talk for a little bit about happy things and get normalized for a moment, and then we'll see where that takes us.
Arius breaks into a giggle.
We'll see where it takes us. I like that.
The conversation started off slowly, with the two discussing their individual travel plans for the coming month, postings on the internet made by mutual acquaintances that they believe were inappropriate,
and Travis's intention of coming to see her before he takes his trip to Cancun with Mimi.
Arias steers the conversation to the sexual adventures they've enjoyed in the past.
There have been a few times where I've been bold enough to just pull you onto the bed and start. And, oh my gosh, remember that time when I came to visit you when I was still lived in California, and I fell asleep on your chair next to your bed, and you woke me up by pulling my pants off and totally licking my pussy?
Yeah. Ah, you've got to admit, though, there's not many guys like that would do that just for fun. Wake you up with a...
Travis replies, now clearly more engaged.
I'm going to tie you to a tree and put it in your ass, all the way.
Arias responds with a beguiling laugh and says, Oh my gosh, that is so debasing. I like it.
Spectators in the gallery exchanged awkward glances, and it seemed like some were biting back laughter as the recording progressed, with the conversation becoming more graphic and the two growing even more uninhibited.
Before I met you, I never jacked off. Once I started, once we started meeting, I don't know. It was once a month, once every 2 weeks. Like, since you've left, I jack off every day, sometimes 2-3 times a day.
We hear Travis tell Arias, who responds with an invitation.
I wish you were here. If you were here, my grandparents are asleep. I'd let you right in my bedroom. We would shut and lock the door and we'd just have a big fuck fest. We'd go at it all night.
Arias continued in a whisper.
You make me feel horny. I seriously think about having sex with you every day, several times a day. I think of how it feels to have your cock deep inside me. I remember it, and I want it again.
Is it wrong that I am glad we started fucking? Travis asked.
Well, if it's wrong, then I don't want to be right,
Arias replies. At this point, it is clear that Arias is masturbating and approaching an orgasm, becoming breathless as she instructs Travis,
Don't come yet, okay? 'Cause then I'll come 2 times, and you can come the 2nd time.
As the impending orgasm approaches, her whispering rises into what seems like an interminable shriek as Travis quietly listens. Once she is done, he compliments her.
Now that was hot. Naturally, the way you moaned there, it sounds like you're a 12-year-old girl having her first orgasm. It is so hot.
Sounds like what?
A 12-year-old girl having her first orgasm, Travis repeats, at which Arias laughs gleefully. Even she sounds as if she understands that this is a comment made in the heat of the moment, not to be taken seriously. Clearly unaffected by the comment, Arias continues the sexual tenor of the conversation, coaxing him on by saying,
Yeah, I want you. I like the way your dick feels against me. It's one thing that you're smooth everywhere, and of course your dick is way smooth. When I have your dick in my mouth, I like putting my lips all over it. I really, really, really want to suck your dick right now so bad,
she says in a sultry voice, and the two gradually reach their orgasm at the same time, with Arias screeching so loudly that she drowns out Travis's moans. As much as it seems like the recording should end, the sexual dialogue continues. Travis discloses that Arias is the one who introduced him to using KY personal lubricant.
Oh, you introduced me to KY, you know that?
Yeah,
Arias responds,
and KY is made for that, so it's good for you.
Even though in her earlier testimony, Arias had painted their time in Ehrenberg as less romantic than she had hoped, on the recording, she romanticizes the moments they had shared there.
Remember the first time you and I grinded, at Ehrenberg, and we both, like, I ended up just coming, and you're like, wow, I came, you came at the same time.
I looked around. There's jizz all over. It was so hot, she said with a giggle. We came together. That was so cool.
At the end of the recording, Judge Stevens called a recess, instructing all parties to be back in the courtroom by 2:50 p.m. When proceedings resumed, Nurmi questioned Arias in detail about what jurors had just heard in the recording. His examination paid particular attention to Travis's comment that Arias's orgasm sounded like that of a 12-year-old girl reaching climax for the first time. Let me ask you this, Nurmi posed. When you recorded this tape and you're living in Wairika in May of 2008, were you 12?
No, Arias replied.
Was this your first orgasm?
No,
she again answered in what seemed an admission that she had indeed climaxed during their phone conversation. But later in the redirect examination, when Nurmi asked her if the orgasms heard on the tape were real, she said no, claiming she was only pretending to climax.
I was faking it because I can't, well, when I'm on the phone, when I do something like that, like masturbating requires both hands.
Arias continued her attack on Travis's character by alleging that he had once told her he wanted her to dress up in a schoolgirl's outfit and wear her hair in braids to act out one of his fantasies, reminiscent of how she willingly posed during their last sexual encounter, memorialized in the photographs taken on June 4, 2008. Chapter 23. The lurid details of Arias's and Travis's sex life had all but dominated Arias's testimony during her 6 days on the witness stand, with Travis's murder feeling more like an afterthought than the reason we were here in the courtroom. Questions about her trip to Mesa finally surfaced on February 19th, toward the end of her direct examination, when Nurmi began asking about Arias's movements in the days leading up to the murder. Arias denied staging the burglary at her grandparents' home to obtain the .25-caliber semi-automatic handgun she had used to shoot Travis. She also claimed that her decision to rent a car in Redding instead of Wairika was based on a good deal she found on the web. She recounted her drive south to Santa Cruz, where she met her ex-boyfriend Matt McCartney for an evening of karaoke. After spending the night at Matt's apartment in Monterey, she made an early morning visit to Daryl Brewer in Pacific Grove. "And did you borrow anything from Mr. Brewer while you were there?" Nurmi asked.
"Yes, I borrowed his gas cans."
"And how many did you borrow from him?"
"Two."
"Why did you borrow 2 gas cans from Daryl Brewer?"
"So that I could, well, gas in Wairika at that time was $4.78 a gallon for regular unleaded. This was 2008. It was very expensive. All gas in California is a little more expensive because they have stricter regulations. So going to Nevada and Utah would have been cheaper, so I wanted to fill up."
With one question and a single answer, the issue of the gas cans had seemingly been laid to rest. Arias's explanation for borrowing the gas containers appeared plausible, especially since she even knew the price per gallon being charged in California for unleaded gas back in 2008. Her carefully crafted response failed to mention the third gas can she had purchased in Salinas, which cost $12.96 plus tax, negating any possible savings from the purchase of gasoline at the cheaper price in Nevada and Utah. "You didn't tell him, keep this a secret?" Nurmi asked of Arias's conversation with Brewer that day.
"No."
"Okay. And when you were having breakfast with Daryl and his son, do you remember telling Daryl that you were going to Mesa?" Nurmi's question failed to address that the conversation Arias had with Brewer about going to Mesa had not occurred that morning at breakfast, but during a telephone conversation the two had in late May when she first asked about borrowing the gas cans.
"I had no plans to go to Mesa at that point, so no, I wouldn't have told him that," she responded.
Arias claimed she next went to Salinas to get a manicure so that her nails looked good for Ryan Burns.
In Pasadena, she stopped at Starbucks and then at Arco because they had cheaper gas, where Arias claimed she filled up the tank and I filled up the gas cans too. Apparently, Arias was not mindful of her previous answer about needing to fill the gas cans in Utah and Nevada, as she was now admitting that she filled them in California, where the gas was more expensive.
Okay, so at this point in time, you have your car full of gas, you have your gas cans full of gas, right? And the plan is to go to Utah, right?
Yes, Arias said, recounting that she then called Ryan Burns to tell him she was on her way.
Did you go to Utah directly after you spoke to Ryan Burns? Nurmi asked.
No. I had been talking to Travis intermittently throughout that time, and the weeks prior when he discovered that I was going to Utah, he started saying, "Why are you going to Utah?" On the very last time I called Travis, it was kind of like, I don't know how to describe it. He had been very sweet. He had been guilting me, kind of making me feel that I was taking this big trip and that I wasn't going to see him, and since I was driving south, he wanted me to come to Mesa. I told him no the first few times. During one conversation, he became angry. During the others, he stayed calm. He has this way of, like, talking in this really sweet voice and making me feel guilty, and he sounded so very sweet. And so it was like, when I called him one more time, it was just like, all right, I'm going. So I went.
Okay. When you arrived at Mr. Alexander's house, did you have a gun with you?
Nurmi asked. No, she answered, although she had told Detective Flores on June 10, 2008, that Travis did not have a gun at his house and had only his two fists for protection.
Did you have a knife with you?
No. Arias claimed she entered the house through a side gate because she knew that Travis locked the front door at night.
Why wouldn't you just knock on the front door? Nurmi inquired.
I had always just come and gone without knocking. It was just easier to walk in. Arias said once inside the house, she found Travis in his office on the first floor with his dog Napoleon sitting on the floor next to him. He had his back to me and he was on his laptop watching music videos or something on YouTube. He didn't see her initially, she said, so she stood in the doorway looking at him until Napoleon's bark alerted him to her presence. That's when Travis turned around and got up out of his chair and came over and greeted me. He had a big smile on his face, and he kissed me on the lips. Arias said the two continued watching the videos for a bit before going into the kitchen, where he implied he wanted to have sex. But she was too tired from the drive, so they went up to his bedroom where they slept, with Arias waking at noon and Travis sleeping until 1 p.m. Nurmi next asked Arias to describe their sexual interactions that afternoon, which Arias claimed involved Travis binding her wrists as part of their foreplay, indicating that Travis then used a knife to cut the ropes in order to free her hands. This was an obvious attempt to account for the knife she would later use to stab him. Her recollection also included their picture-taking session and regular vanilla sex. Jurors again viewed the photographs of Arias posing naked on Travis's bed, her hair in braids, with Nurmi directing their attention to Arias's shaved pubic region in the photograph. Travis didn't like hair, she said. She also talked about a sex video that she claimed the two recorded on his Sanyo camera that they deleted after viewing it together. Arias claimed that after the sex, she took a shower and got ready to hit the road, adding that she put the sheets from Travis's bed in the washing machine, as they typically did each time the two had sex. Even though her car was packed and she was ready to depart Mesa at 2 p.m., Arias said she stayed around for a bit to watch the CDs containing photographs taken during their trips that she made for Travis that had been hanging around in her briefcase for months. She described Travis growing angry when the CDs wouldn't play on his computer, saying that when they finally did, he noticed that they were scratched and blamed her for holding on to them for too long. To blow off steam, she said Travis threw one of the CDs at the wall, causing it to ricochet off the wall, land on the desk, and then roll off onto her head before ending up on the carpet. According to Arius, she was now worried,
because I feel like the trip had gone pretty well at that point. Now he's going to get angry, or I've done something stupid again, and the trip is going to get ruined.
Arius alleged that, in his anger, Travis grabbed her by the arm, spun her around, bent her over the desk, pulled down her pants, and pressed his groin against her buttock. Based on that movement, did you believe that he wanted to have sex with you again?
Yes. I could feel that he had an erection.
Okay. And at that point in time, did you want to have sex with Mr. Alexander?
Well, yeah, actually I did, because it was better than him getting mad. I didn't want his anger to escalate to the levels that it had in the past.
Nurmi inquired, so your mindset on June 4th, 2008 was anything to avoid a fight. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, in that moment, yes.
Arius said, claiming Travis was now a lot calmer. Did you leave then? Nurmi asked.
No. We decided to go upstairs and take pictures. More pictures.
According to Arius, this impromptu picture-taking session was at her insistence after she convinced Travis that the photographs would show off his recent weight loss.
The Cancun trip was announced in 2007, I think right before I broke up with him. And so he assumed he was going to win the trip, and so he was getting into shape. The prior summer, he was almost 240, and so he had lost a lot of weight, and he was down to, like, a little over 200. His goal was to have a six-pack. He wasn't quite there yet, but he was close. And when he got to that point, he wanted photos taken of what he had accomplished.
Court ended that afternoon with Arius testifying that she had wanted their visit to end on a positive note. And since the pictures on the CDs were ruined, she wanted to do something else to make him happy. Arius's testimony was in its eighth day when she returned to court on February 20th to finally testify to Travis's killing. Nurmi opened his examination by asking Arius about the photo shoot she and Travis had decided to conduct in the late afternoon of June 4th. And this was to take place in the bathroom?
Yes.
And why was the shower area selected?
It was selected for the water. We were going to go for a certain effect with the pictures and the water, Arius said.
Tell us what happens once he gets in the shower.
I was taking pictures of him. We were trying out different poses, and at one point he was sitting and I was taking pictures. I was probably a few feet from the shower so that the water didn't get on the camera, and I was showing him the photos, and we were deleting some. And at one point, when I went to delete the photo, as I moved the camera, it slipped out of my hand. Like, it bounced, and I almost caught it. But I didn't catch it, and it landed on the mat, and then it rolled onto the tile.
Where were you when this took place, relative to the shower?
I was crouched by the shower. I might have been on the mat, or the edge of the mat. At that point, Travis flipped out again. And he stood up, and he stepped out of the shower, and he picked me up. I was crouching, but he lifted me up, as he was screaming that I was a stupid idiot. And he body-slammed me again on the tile. He told me that a 5-year-old can hold a camera better than I can. And when I hit the tile, I rolled over on the side and started running down the hallway. And I don't know why I didn't run out of the room. I ran to the closet, because the door was open, was my thought. I could hear his footsteps chasing me, so I ran into the closet and I slammed the door. And I intended to run through the opposite end of the door because it had an exit. And as soon as I got in there and began to run, I remembered where he kept the gun. So I grabbed it. I jumped up on the shelf. He kept it on the very top. I grabbed it and I ran out the other door as he was opening the door. And he ran, chasing me, and I turned around and pointed it at him so that he would stop chasing me. We were in the middle of the bathroom. I pointed it at him with both of my hands. I thought that would stop him. He got like a linebacker. He got kind of low and grabbed my waist. But before he did that, as he was lunging at me, the gun went off.
Arius claimed she didn't mean to shoot Travis.
I didn't even think I was holding the trigger. I just was pointing it at him, and I didn't even know that I shot him. It just went off. And he lunged at me,
and we fell really hard against the tile toward the other wall. So at this point, I didn't even know if he had been shot. We were struggling and wrestling, and he was getting on top of me. He's grabbing at my clothes, and I got up, and he's just screaming angry. And after I broke away from him, he said, "Fucking kill you, bitch!"
Although to this point she had been able to recall even the minutest details of her relationship with Travis, her memory of the events in the bathroom as she fought for her life became fuzzy.
"There's a lot of that day that I don't remember," she said. "There are a lot of gaps."
"Okay," Nurmi said, seemingly working to jar her memory. "Once you broke away from him, what do you remember?"
"Almost nothing for a long time. There's like a huge gap. And the most clear memory I have at that point is driving in the desert."
"Let me ask you this. Do you remember stabbing Mr. Alexander?"
"I have no memory of stabbing him."
"Do you remember dragging him across the floor?"
"No. I just remember trying to get away from him."
"Do you remember placing him in the shower?"
"I'm sorry, that's... no. I have a vague memory of putting the knife in the dishwasher."
"What else do you remember?" Nurmi asked.
"Not much,"
Arius stated flatly, claiming that the next thing she remembered was driving west.
"Because I remember the sun was in my eyes for a while. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't have GPS anymore. I hit a lot of stoplights. And then, eventually, I was in the desert."
Arius testified that she did recall taking the gun with her when she left Travis's house that day.
"I remember throwing it in the desert."
"Explain to us if you believed that Mr. Alexander was alive or dead," Nurmi asked.
"I didn't know, but I didn't think he was... I thought he was not alive at that point."
As part of her direct examination, Arius detailed her movements in the hours, days, weeks, and months after the killing, including the many lies she'd told along the way, something Nurmi sought to address in his final questions to her on the stand. "Since Mr. Alexander's death was discovered, you told one version of events in which you weren't there, and another version of events where intruders came into the home, killed Mr. Alexander, and you escaped. Why did you then now decide to tell us what really happened? Why did you decide to come forward with all these things that you've been hiding? Mr. Alexander's sexual interests, the sexual relationship, the violence. Why did you feel comfortable coming forth with that information?" Arius paused, readjusted herself in the chair, and looked at the jurors.
"It wasn't an overnight decision by any means," she began. "From day one, there's a part of me that always wanted to, but didn't dare do that. I would rather have gone to my grave without confirming that I could have done something like that. I was extremely ashamed of it. It wasn't in line with who I am or how I had been living my life all the way up to that point. So, as the years went by, however, I began to... It feels very fraudulent from day one, especially when there are so many nice people reaching out to you, and they believe you or they believe in you. It feels wrong. It was a process that happened over a long period of time, but by the spring of 2010, I confessed."
"When you say you confessed, what do you mean by confessed?"
"I basically told everyone what I could remember of the day, and that the intruder story was all BS, pretty much."
"That's all the questions I have, Judge," Nurmi said, paving the way for me to begin my cross-examination. Chapter 24. Cross-examination is a bit of an art. The evidentiary rules allow questioning beyond matters raised in the direct examination as long as the inquiry touches on facts in dispute. So my approach is to always ask questions that are germane to the case, but I like to start by inquiring about matters that are not expected by the defendant, avoiding rehearsed answers. In the case of Jodi Ann Arius,
I don't think she anticipated that I would begin her cross-examination on the morning of February 21st by talking about unflattering names she had called family members in conversations with Travis that had not been discussed in her direct examination. I wanted to begin by showing jurors she had a double standard, which she believed allowed her to make demeaning comments about others while expecting those around her to refrain from engaging in the same type of name-calling. I also planned to weave into the first part of my questioning that the injury to her left ring finger she claimed to have sustained during an assault by Travis on January 22, 2008, the day after she alleged to have found him masturbating to pictures of young boys, had actually happened during her attack on Travis on June 4, 2008. I knew these two topics were unrelated, which is why I chose them, because it would make it difficult for Arias to predict the questions I would pose. I had learned from her interviews with Detective Flores that conducting my cross-examination in a linear fashion would be ineffective. That was the approach he had employed during his interrogation, which allowed Arias to become comfortable and craft the story about intruders killing Travis. Preparing scripted questions in advance, even as to minor points, would have been counterproductive, because Arias ad-libbed even as to undisputed facts, rendering useless the next question on the scripted page. "Ma'am," I began, showing Arias Exhibit 413, a close-up photograph of her and her sister Angela with a date stamp of May 10, 2008, that defense witness Lonnie Dworkin had recovered from the memory card of Arias's Canon camera. "Do you recognize this exhibit?" I asked, knowing that she was familiar with the photograph because her witness had introduced it into evidence on her behalf. "That's a picture of you, correct?" When Arias agreed, I asked her about the teen with the dyed red hair in the photo with her. "And the other one is a picture of your dumb sister, correct?" "That's my sister," she affirmed, her clipped response indicating her displeasure with my characterization of Angela. "She's not dumb." "Well, do you remember having a conversation with Travis Alexander back on May 10th, 2008? I asked.
"Yes."
"And during that conversation, isn't it true you said, 'But I honestly think,' talking about Angela, 'she's a little dumb'? You said that, right?" I asked, referring to comments she made about her sister during the May 10th, 2008 sexually explicit phone call with Travis.
"Yes, I called her dumb and stupid."
"Did I ask you whether or not you called her stupid?" I countered, in an effort to prevent her from controlling the questioning.
"No."
"I asked you whether or not you called her dumb, right?"
"Yes."
"Now take a look at Exhibit 452, I instructed, showing Arias another photograph of her and Angela taken from a different angle that showed more than just their faces. "Do you recognize the two people?"
"Yes,"
Arias replied, enabling me to move it into evidence. "And what date was the photograph taken?" I asked, directing Arias to look at the date on the back of the exhibit, which read May 2nd, 2008. "And with regard to this photograph, it also features you and your sister, the one that you said was stupid, correct?"
"Yes,"
she said, admitting to engaging in name-calling, which allowed me to point out that she was upset with Travis for engaging in this very same behavior. "Now, with regard to this name-calling, your text message was that you were upset at some point because Mr. Alexander said that you were going to turn out just like your mother, or you were acting like your mother. Do you remember that text?"
"Yes."
I followed up by referring to a portion of her direct examination where she had detailed the bad words Travis supposedly said about her mother.
"I don't remember."
"Do you have a problem with your memory, ma'am?"
"Sometimes," she responded.
Citing memory issues would become one of the ways Arias would attempt to avoid answering my questions when it appeared that her responses might reveal an inconvenient truth. "And you can tell us, for example, what type of sex you had with Mr. Alexander many years ago, but you're having trouble telling us what you said a couple of days ago?" I asked.
"When I'm under stress, yeah, it affects my memory," Arias retorted, refusing to back down from the excuse.
I thought you said the relationship with Mr. Alexander was very stressful.
Some of the sex wasn't.
Pardon? I asked, not sure if I had heard her answer correctly.
Some of the sex wasn't, she repeated.
Before this point in the trial, Arias had attempted to present herself as someone who was meek and compliant in her sexual dealings with Travis, someone with religious values. She had spent an inordinate amount of time on direct examination describing the sordid details of her many sexual moments with Travis, replaying them for the jury as if they were musical pieces with different beats and tempo, but all with the same bad note. She just could not say no. She had spoken of their first encounter in Murrieta, California, where she claimed he foisted himself on her, performing oral sex until, thankfully, he moved his mouth away. She even lamented their time in Ehrenberg, where she expected a weekend of romance only to have the time spent grinding or having oral sex, but all the while Travis seemed distant, making her feel like a prostitute. She avowed that her willingness to engage in anal sex after she allegedly discovered Travis masturbating to images of young boys was nothing more than a self-sacrificing act on her part, done only to calm Travis's pedophilic urges. So it was quite revelatory that she was now saying that she had liked some of the sex, in direct contradiction of her answers when she was questioned by defense counsel. So you did enjoy the sex then, is that what you're telling me?
At times I did, she admitted blandly.
But you did indicate, as part of your examination, that Mr. Alexander at some point said something about your grandfather also, that he made some pejorative comments, some bad comments about him, right? I solicited, switching back to a specific comment Arias made during her direct testimony in an attempt to attack Travis's character and paint him in a bad light.
My grandfather, Arias answered. Yes, his name,
she said, making sure the jury knew that Travis allegedly belittled her grandfather's good name. One of the things that seems to be coming out here is that you seem to have a double standard here with regard to making comments about people, don't you? I asked. Judge Stevens overruled Nurmi's objection that my question was argumentative, allowing Arias to respond.
I do, she said, but then immediately backtracked, offering justifications for her responses.
When she became upset over Travis's comment about her grandfather, it was because she was already upset about something else that day. As for calling Angela dumb and stupid, she made those statements at a time when she was feeling sentimental. You have a different standard for Mr. Alexander, correct? Yes or no? When Arias responded no, I continued this line of questioning by referring to another, more illustrative example of her double standard when it came to Travis, recalling an incident that happened less than 2 months after she broke up with him. Back in August of 2007, you went over to Mr. Alexander's house, and at that time you were broken up with Mr. Alexander, right?
I had broken up with him, Arias replied.
And you broke up with him on June 29th, 2007, right? But you felt that it was okay for you to go over to his house in August 2007, didn't you?
After he told me, she said, in an attempt to justify her action.
Yes or no, I asked, my voice rising. Did you feel it was okay to go over to his house?
I said yes, Arias challenged, even though she had not previously provided me with an affirmative answer.
Arias's answers were being delivered with a perceptible edge, and on numerous occasions she appeared to scold me. I said yes, or I said no. The tone in her responses ordained my continuing use of a stern approach to overcome her obvious unwillingness to give straightforward answers. And you started to peep into the house, didn't you? I continued, my voice still raised.
Yes.
So you went around the back to look, right?
I went around the back to get in, she admonished me.
But when you got to the back to get in, you started to look at what was going on, right? You saw something inside that upset you, right? You saw Mr. Alexander, right?
I did not know it was him at first, she replied, appearing reluctant to provide a more definitive answer.
When I pressed, she admitted that she saw Travis, and he was with a woman she did not recognize.
And you were able to see that they were making out, right?
Oh yeah, they were.
So what happened then is you were actually watching what they were doing then, right?
Briefly, yes.
And after you saw this, one of the things you did was that you took off, right?
Yes.
And you felt strongly enough about this that the next day you called your father, right?
I called my parents' house and my dad answered.
Yes or no? You spoke to your father.
I did speak to him.
And you were crying, right? And you were upset about this, right? And you told him why you were upset, right?
Yes.
I thought you said before that you didn't discuss these issues involving you and Mr. Alexander.
Not typically.
You said you didn't yesterday and all the days before. Remember telling us that?
I asked, referring to her previous testimony in response to Nurmi's questions. The violence, yes, she replied, her way of clarifying that she had simply been referring to the alleged domestic violence in her relationship with Travis, not Travis's behavior with other women.
Oh, I see, I said. But you did discuss the fact that you saw him kissing somebody else to your father, right?
Yes.
And as a result of that, you decided to go talk to Mr. Alexander about it, right?
Yes.
What in the world gave you the right to go talk to an ex-boyfriend? I probed. According to you, you had broken up with him. What right do you have?
Nurmi objected that my question was argumentative, and his objection was sustained by the judge. I rephrased the question, forcing Arius into acknowledging her double standard.
Weren't you broken up?
Yes.
You were being territorial with him, weren't you?
No.
Then why in the world would you even care what he was doing? I asked.
Because he was trying to court me back,
she snapped, justifying her unannounced appearance at his house that evening. And so you could have left that situation alone, but you decided to confront him anyway, right?
Of course.
In keeping with my non-linear approach, I asked Arius about her sexual encounter with Ryan Burns immediately following the sexual interlude in the afternoon of June 4th, 2008, with Travis Alexander. At the end, right when you killed him, you indicated that you were monogamous with him, right?
Yes.
And at that time, you then left the killing scene, if you will, and you went right to Utah, right? And you went up to Utah, ma'am. You ended up with somebody named Ryan Burns, and you ended up in his bed, right?
I think it was a love sack, Arius replied, clearly unfazed at the audacity of rendezvousing with Burns after just having slept with and killed another man.
Arius contended that she wasn't sure if Travis was actually dead when she arrived in Utah on June 5, 2008 to meet with Burns, claiming that she didn't know Travis was dead until she received confirmation on June 10th. So if you didn't think he was dead, then it's okay for you at that point to sort of roll around with Mr. Burns?
I'm single, Arius answered in a snit, ignoring that Travis was also single at the time when she confronted him about kissing another woman. I believed she had been taken sufficiently off course that I could now circle back to the reason I had begun my cross-examination with the photographs of her and her sister Angela, the injury to her left finger. With regard to Exhibit 452, it does show you, right, correct? I asked, showing her a photograph that had been taken on May 15, 2008. Yes.
Shows something else on there, though, doesn't it? Doesn't it show your hand?
Yes,
Arius replied, unaware of where I was going with my inquiry. And in fact, let me show you another close-up of your hand, I said, presenting her with Exhibit 453, which was an enlargement of her hand pictured in the previous photograph. Directing Arius's attention to the ring finger on her left hand, I asked, "Do you remember that you testified that on January 22, 2008, you and Mr. Alexander were involved in some sort of violent encounter? And you told us that during that encounter he threw you down, and while you were down he kicked you. And when he kicked you, ma'am, one of the things that happened was that you put up your left hand. Do you remember telling us that?"
"Yes, both hands,"
Arius replied, now embellishing her story to include both hands. Well, you told us specifically about your left hand, and when you put up your left hand, according to you, he kicked you, and he damaged your ring finger on the left hand. And, in fact, you even held it up for us, didn't you?
Yes.
And it was crooked when you showed it to us, wasn't it?
It's bent, yes.
Instructing her to hold her finger up for the jury once again, I asked her why, if Travis had injured her finger on January 22, 2008, it did not appear bent in the photo of her and her sister taken almost 4 months later on May 15, 2008, less than 1 month before the murder.
My finger is bent there, Arius insisted, even though the photograph showed otherwise.
Hold up your finger again, I directed, sideways so we can all see it.
When my fingers are straightened, this one stays bent, she said,
raising her left hand and showing her ring finger bent at a 90-degree angle. Well, you talked to Ryan Burns about it, didn't you? I asked. And you told him that that finger, the left ring finger, had been damaged, right? Injured, didn't you?
I don't know if it was the left, Arius submitted.
You don't remember telling him it was the left ring finger, ma'am? Again, do you have a memory problem?
Occasionally, she replied, latching on to the parachute I was apparently providing.
And so some of the things you told us, for example, then, about things in the past, you may have also had memory problems, right? And so whatever you told us in the past is somewhat suspect, then, because your memory is lacking?
I only told things that I remember clearly that are crystallized in my mind.
I reminded Arius of the bandage she was wearing on her finger when she arrived in Utah on June 5th, and she and Ryan Burns joined friends at a restaurant. And it was your left finger, wasn't it?
No.
It was your right finger, then? Is that what you are saying?
It was two fingers, Arius maintained. Two right fingers.
Do you remember your conversation with Detective Flores about this issue involving the finger? And that you told him that on June 4th, 2008, you had been over at Mr. Alexander's home, and that some girl had come in, and during whatever happened on June 4th, you told Detective Flores that it was your left finger that had been damaged? Do you remember that?
I asked, requesting to move into evidence the portion of the video containing Arius's conversation with Flores on July 16th, 2008, so the jurors could view her contradictory statements for themselves. After playing the video, I directed Arius's attention to the comments she made to the detective that day, indicating that the supposed female intruder had cut her right there, as she pointed to a specific location on her left ring finger.
Look at it there, I said, directing her attention to the monitor. The finger had the same aspect or the same angle to it that your finger does now, doesn't it?
Yes, Arius conceded.
Ma'am, the injury to your finger happened on June 4th, 2008, not January 22nd, 2008, didn't it?
That's not correct, she pronounced in a dictatorial fashion, even after having viewed herself admitting to Detective Flores that the finger had been injured on June 4th, 2008. To further discount her claim and show she was being untruthful, I pointed to two entries in Arius's journal, dated January 20th and January 24th, 2008, which I asked her to review.
And nowhere do you mention either in this January 24th of 08 or January 20th of 08 document, you don't mention anything about this physical encounter with Mr. Alexander that you told us happened on January 22nd of 2008, do you?
No, I would never.
I'm not asking if you would ever. Do you mention it there?
I said no, Arius sniped.
You do say in Exhibit 456, the entry dated January 24, 2008, I haven't written because there is nothing noteworthy to report, right? So to you, getting this injury to the left ring finger, that's no big deal, right?
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, you didn't call the police. You didn't get medical care for it, right?
Not professional medical care.
Ma'am, did you go to the doctor to get it looked at? Did you go to the hospital to get it looked at?
No.
And with regard to your conversation that you had with Detective Flores on July 16th, 2008, you didn't tell him anything about that, did you? In fact, you told him a different story, didn't you? You told him something about these two people and how you got that injury to your finger, right?
Yes.
So you're saying that what you told the detective was a lie?
Yes,
she conceded, knowing that she had nothing to lose because she had already admitted that she had been untruthful with Flores about who killed Travis. So, in your view, when do you decide to tell the truth? When you're in this court and no place else?
No.
Touching on Arias's claim that she walked in on Travis masturbating on January 21st, 2008, I reminded her of the testimony she gave on direct examination, claiming to have been concerned about Travis spending the night at a friend's home, knowing that the friend had a child. You made it sound like there was such a big problem, and yet you didn't go to that person and tell them, hey, he's got this issue, did you?
No.
You didn't go to the police and tell them anything. I posed, pointing out that she also did not report Travis to Child Protective Services, instead choosing to keep this allegation to herself for 2 years after his death.
I think it's almost 3 years ago at this point,
Arias said, changing the reference point, seemingly oblivious to how her response might be construed by jurors. As the first day of my cross-examination wore on, I continued to chip away at the credibility of her claim that Travis was a pedophile. To further discount her allegation, I wanted to pin her down by soliciting more precise details of her movements on January 21, 2008. The day she claimed to have caught Travis masturbating to the photo of the little boy, something that she would make excruciatingly difficult with her vague responses. What time do you claim that you saw this masturbatory activity? I asked.
I don't know the exact time, but it was afternoon, well before it was dark. It was still light out.
Okay, can you be more specific?
It was afternoon.
All right. Was it 2 o'clock? If it was so noteworthy, why can't you remember the time?
It's kind of traumatic.
Weren't your senses heightened at that time that you saw this? Were you angry?
I was sick to my stomach. I mean, it's something I'm never going to forget, but I wish I could.
You are never going to forget it, but you have forgotten the time.
I know it was afternoon.
You worked at Mimi's Cafe. You had been working that day. Your shift was over. What time did your shift start?
It varied.
That day, what time did your shift start?
In the morning.
What time?
Sometime in the morning. I don't know the exact time.
You don't know the exact time, yet you knew you had to be there that day at a certain time. What time does Mimi's open?
I've never opened Mimi's, so I'm not sure, but they open early.
Was it an 8-hour shift then?
No, they aren't 8-hour shifts.
How many hours was your shift?
It depends on the flow of business.
I understand that it may depend on that. How many hours did you work on January 21st, 2008, on this day that this horrible thing you claim happened?
I would only be able to tell you a range. I know the range, but not the exact hours.
Ma'am, you had a lot of memory for a lot of events involving sexual instances with Mr. Alexander. Yet you seem to be having problems with your memory here today. And you also alluded to a little bit that you have problems with your memory. Your problems with the memory, is this of recent vintage?
Define recent,
Arias countered sharply. Since you started testifying.
No, it goes back further than that. I don't even know if I'd call it a problem. I don't remember every single thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life.
Ma'am, your memory issues...
I wouldn't call them issues, Arias corrected me again.
Well, you don't want to call them problems. You don't want to call them issues, right?
I didn't say I didn't want to.
All right, we'll call them issues then. With regard to these memory issues that you claim to have, when did you start having them?
It depends on the type of memory issues.
If it benefits you, you have a memory issue? I asked, to which Nurmi objected. Or by virtue, to which Nurmi also objected. Well, I began, about to formulate my next question, when Arias blurted out a response.
"When it hurts sometimes," she admitted over Nermi's objection.
"You say that you have memory problems, but it depends on the circumstances, right?"
"That's right.
And give me the factors. I don't want to know about the specific circumstances. What factors influence you having a memory problem?"
"Usually when men like you are screaming at me or grilling me, or someone like Travis is doing the same," she retorted, her body tensing angrily.
And with that flash of anger, everyone in the courtroom, including the jury, could now imagine Jody Ann Arias wearing the same pants with a vertical stripe running down the leg, standing just outside the shower, moments before she took out her knife and stabbed Travis Alexander in the chest. Chapter 25.
Jody Arias's responses to questions posed by the media had been beautifully worded and elegantly delivered, falling from her lips like water flowing down a clear stream. She had been just as persuasive in her presentation to family, friends, and police, even if her tale had changed several times. Although she had been just as impressive in her performance on direct examination, she was now missing her cues as she tripped over her lines during the first day of cross-examination. There would be no critical acclaim as she defended her most recent story because reality had started to set in with almost every answer that she gave. Arias had a problem with the truth. In formulating my cross-examination, I had been careful to emphasize only major areas rather than quibble with her about trivial matters, which would have been a waste of time. The sexual relationship with Travis had been a mutual experience, so I necessarily had to question her assertion that Travis always forced her into having sex because she could not say no. She had been implicit in her testimony that she was no longer being untruthful because she had sworn to tell the truth, causing me to expose how she manipulated her words.
"Ma'am, you have a problem with the truth, telling the truth, don't you?" I began.
"Not typically," Arias replied.
"Well, when it's to your benefit, you will lie, right?" I asked, drawing an objection from Nermi, which was sustained by Judge Stevens, forcing me to take a different approach to illustrate the point. "Ma'am, do you remember having a conversation with Detective Flores of the Mesa Police Department back on July 15, 2008? I continued, drawing the courtroom's attention to the video monitors. I played an excerpt from the videotaped interview in which Arias tells Flores that she would help police with their investigation in any way she can. Turning to Arias, I asked, "That's not true, is it?"
"I don't know," she responded. "I guess it depends on what help means," she answered.
"Yes or no," I pressed. "Were you there to help him?"
"I don't know," she resisted.
"Were you there to tell the truth?"
"No," she said, finally admitting what she could not deny.